Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a deadly attack in New York. Republicans unveil their tax plan. Robert Mueller brings first indictments and tech executives in the hot seat over Russian meddling. The long-awaited Republican tax bill arrived Thursday. Now they want to fast-track. President Trump called it a gift to the middle class.
We are giving them a big, beautiful Christmas present in the form of a tremendous tax cut.
Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort indicted this week for money laundering and more. Here he was surrendering at the FBI field office in Washington on Monday.
Any reaction, Mr. Manafort?
Good morning. Good morning.
Mr. Manafort, did you collude with Russians?
Paul Manafort.
And a deadly truck attack on a New York bike path killed 8.
Be advised, we have multiple people on the ground. We got multiple casualties. This is a mass casualty situation here.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, Josh Gerstein of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How does the tax bill look to you? What do you make of Mueller's indictments, DNC rigging charges, Russians online? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Josh Gerstein, reporter for Politico covering the White House and the Justice Department. Josh, welcome back to On Point. Hello, Josh. Are you there, my friend? We'll get Josh on board here. Joining us from New York is Catherine Rampell, columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, welcome to On Point.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Catherine.
Catherine, can we dive right in on this tax plan? This is an enormous overhaul, maybe the biggest in, what, 3 decades or so. Now it's out. The president is suggesting he wants it wrapped up by Christmas. What's at the heart of this plan, and is that timetable feasible?
The heart of this plan is essentially tax cuts for wealthier people and corporations. Some middle-class people, middle-class households, will face tax cuts, but many will actually face tax increases. In general, the bill increases the deficit, which will actually have the long-term effect of potentially slowing down growth because it'll be more costly for the United States to borrow. So that's, you know, sort of the opposite of what Republicans have been pitching. So, you know, in general, tax cuts for the rich, bigger deficits, those are the themes. As to whether this timetable is feasible, there are still a lot of obstacles in the way. A number of Republican senators have expressed concerns, sometimes concerns that if met would be in contradiction with one another about, you know, increasing the generosity of some tax cuts, but also decreasing the cost of the bill and so on. So there, you know, I think it's very unrealistic actually at this point to expect this to be smooth sailing.
Catherine, what's the why behind this? I mean, we see the latest numbers are out today. We've got unemployment down to 4.1%, the lowest level since December of 2000. That's a long time. What's the why for pushing this big bill? You say with some cuts for the middle class, big cuts for the rich. Why? If with that deficit attached, why is the GOP on it?
Because this is the Republican MacGuffin. You know, their motivating force is and has been for many years tax cuts. That's their number one priority. If you're a Keynesian or even, you know, paying attention to the business cycle, now is not the time to have a big deficit finance tax cut. You usually think about these kinds of measures as taking place when the economy is suffering, when unemployment is high, and when you're trying to sort of have the government step in and goose demand by having some sort of spending program, either through direct spending or through the tax side. So the why doesn't quite hold up if you're looking at where we are in the business cycle. But as I said, what Republicans really care about, the donors and the legislators themselves, is a big tax cut. They've been promising it for years. So the timing, I think, doesn't quite matter.
The GOP pushing this hard this week on Capitol Hill and at the White House as a middle-class tax cut. Here's the House Speaker Paul Ryan describing how he says the plan would help the average American family.
With this plan, the typical family of four will save $1,182 a year on their taxes. For many families, Having an additional $1,182 more will make a real difference.
Typical family. I mean, of course, you can play with numbers. By all estimates, the big weight of the advantages here go to higher income earners. Democrats quick to pounce on that. Here was House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
It is, again, deficit exploding, multi-trillion dollar giveaway to the wealthiest and corporations delivered on the backs of our children, our seniors, and hardworking Americans.
Josh Gerstein joins us, covers the White House and Justice Department for Politico. Josh, how's the White House presenting this? The president's talking about a big Christmas present for the middle class. But what about all the analysis that says the weight of this goes to the wealthy?
Well, the White House has been concerned about that over time. You know, the president has said on a couple of occasions that he would be fine with not giving millionaires any tax cut. You're quite right, Tom. The way this is structured, a big chunk of it, for example, goes to reducing the corporate tax rate. And at least the most immediate impact of that is going to be on people who have a lot of money to invest in corporations and therefore will go primarily to wealthy people. So they are concerned about that framing, but the president continues to come out day after day and say that this will be the biggest tax cut in history, even though I think many, if not all, of the analysts who look at it are a little dubious about that that claim.
I want to ask about fissures within the GOP, because they may need everybody to push this through. Of course, one of the things they're doing here is getting rid of most of the deduction for state and local taxes in high tax states. That's a big deal. Will hit everybody hard, including Republican constituents. Here's Republican Peter King of New York, congressman, said he'll vote against the tax bill that would and it's a deal breaker, he said, for him. Here's what he told Fox Business on Wednesday.
State income tax and the local property tax, it's essential that they remain. But the state income tax, that would have to take away that deduction would have a really devastating impact on New York State, and it could cause people to leave the state.
Catherine, what are you hearing about the politics of this within the GOP? Can they get unanimity or enough to push it through? In the Senate, they need practically everyone.
Right, especially since they're doing this without any involvement from Democrats, right? That's the key here. They need
every
Republican. Is that
clear? The president's talked about Democrats maybe coming in.
Yeah, but Democrats have not been involved in writing this bill. They have been kept in the dark, basically, up until the unveiling of it. I mean, maybe that'll change, but the expectation right now is that Republicans are steering the ship and that they're basically excluding Democrats, which is fraught for them, right? Because it means that every marginal vote is empowered within the Republican Party. And as I mentioned earlier, some of the things that these marginal votes, you know, like a Corker, for example, or a Rubio, what they want are in contradiction with one another. So Corker says that he's concerned about the cost of this bill, but Rubio, for example, thinks that the child tax credit should be expanded, which would increase the cost of the bill. So the problem is that a lot of these demands are in tension. You had this clip from a representative from New York about the state and local tax deduction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that is particularly fraught, in part because there are Republicans from blue states, and also, you know, this hasn't gotten as much coverage, but I wrote about it today. This could potentially accelerate major fiscal crises in a number of states because states are already facing budget crunches. You know, New Jersey, Illinois, California, states that are heavily reliant on these income taxes, and it will become increasingly difficult for them to maintain the current level of taxes, let alone increase taxes, which they'll probably need to do at some point to pay for their unfunded pension liabilities. If this tax break
goes away, we're talking here California, Illinois, New York, New Jersey. On up through
right.
Some states in New England with high state taxes.
Right.
Some in worse shape than others, but this could make the ones in tough shape, Illinois, for example, could be tougher shape, I guess.
Yes, exactly. So, this hasn't gotten as much attention, but it's not only about potentially voters being upset about their taxes going up, which is likely to happen to a lot of people in New York, New Jersey, those kinds of places, if this deduction goes away, but also that, you know, states could potentially go into bankruptcy because they already have these severe budget crises, and it will make the politics of solving those crises much more difficult.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the politics of this? For years and years, the Republicans absolutely draconian on deficits. You know, so absolutely clear and strong against deficits. And now you got a $1.5 trillion deficit at best baked in here. What do you make of that transition, Jack, the Republicans saying, well, that's all right?
Vertiginous is the word that occurs to me when I see Paul Paul Ryan. I mean, what was he saying in 2010, 2012? He was talking about, we'll be Greece. He was saying about the Obama
deficit. If we don't get a grip on the deficit.
Yeah, and suddenly all that is out the window, and we have this, you know, now deficit spending or deficit going into deficit could be justified if, I think as Catherine has said, that we were in a recession, if the economy were slowing down. But as you pointed out, all the numbers are good. It could be justified if we were borrowing to do a huge infrastructure program.
Because investing in the future kind of thing.
Investing in the future. That pays itself back. But to do this just to, you know, make the future safe for mediocre heirs of large fortunes, essentially to confer an aristocracy on the children of wealth.
Because the estate tax goes away because so much flows to the top.
Yes, and you know, it has no justification economically. Now, the argument that somehow, I saw Kevin Hassett make this argument, the White House economic advisor, each, you know, workers will get an average of $4,000 a year more because money will be, taxes will be cut on corporations. As somebody said, that's bank shot economics.
That's counting on a much stronger economy bringing those benefits to the middle class.
Yes, it's the evidence.
But what's
of
wrong with hoping for that, with gunning for that, Jack? We need a stronger economy. The numbers don't add up.
We do, and there are ways of creating growth. You know, you could have a demand-side tax cut. 40% of Americans don't pay the income tax. They pay that regressive payroll tax that could be cut sharply, and it could be paid for by, say, a transaction tax on big trades on Wall Street.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire, but short on time? You just need the right tools. Smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the New York attack, the GOP tax plan, Mueller's first move, and more. Catherine Rampell is with us, columnist for The Washington Post. Josh Gerstein is here, covers the White House and the Justice Department for Politico. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us on the tax plan Republicans want to have through by the end of the year by Christmas, a Christmas president, the Donald Trump says, on Mueller's first indictments, on that terrible killing in New York and a bike path there, visitors to this country and others just mowed down by the immigrant from Uzbekistan who wants the ISIS flag on his hospital wall. Got a lot of colors on this tax front. Charlie in Atlanta, Georgia. Charlie, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk with you again.
You too.
The Republicans really ought to call this the STOP Act for screw the ordinary people.
What do you mean?
Because that's what they're doing. When Paul Ryan says the family of four will get $1,200 extra a year, do the math. $1,200 divided by 12 months is $100 a month, right, for a family of four.
Yeah.
That's $25 a month per person in their family of four. That's less than a dollar a day. This amounts to absolutely nothing. Kevin Brady, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, was on PBS NewsHour last night, and Judy Woodruff interviewed him, and it was all nothing but gobbledygook. And basically, what Brady is saying is, this is not really a tax bill. What it really is an economic stimulus bill. And that's a real bunch of BS, because nothing in this bill, no legislator can justify this as a means of creating jobs.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's hold it right there, Charlie. We've got your critique. You say not much for the middle class, not an economic stimulus bill. Catherine Rampell, you've covered business for a long time. Really? I mean, that's the heart of the way the president's described this. This is going to fire up the economy, and that will come back and benefit the middle class.
That seems highly unlikely to me. First of all, this example that Paul Ryan and other Republicans have given about the middle, you know, the $59,000 a year household with family of four getting a tax cut. Actually, that's true only in the first year, the numbers that Paul Ryan has given.
Those
that
are temporary?
Yeah. Maybe? So because the way that they have proposed to restructure the tax code has some tax credits that benefit that family in the first year but actually phase out. David Kamen, who is a tax professor at NYU Law, had a nice Medium post explaining how this would work.
Phase out. Do the benefits for the rich and corporations phase out also?
Some of them do and some of them don't. Most of them do not. Because
so they're permanent, but this is temporary.
Right. So it's complicated, but basically the proposal gets rid of the personal exemptions and replaces them with something called a family flexibility credit or something which is not permanent. So that's why in year 10 or whatever it is, taxes would actually go up for that standard example that Republicans have been giving. I will say, though, that some of the corporate side changes also expire, but it's unlikely that they would be allowed to expire. The reason that, for example, there's this section that says that companies can immediately expense various kinds of deductions.
Yep.
Right. That they could immediately deduct the full cost of expensing.
Yep.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yep.
And that would expire after, I believe, 5 years. And the reason why is because it's too expensive for them to say that it would go on forever. And
so it's an accounting thing. They wouldn't come in under the limits on deficit if they
right.
let it go on. But corporations will want it to go on once they've got it, I suppose.
Right. And I think that there will be a lot of political pressure on legislators to make this permanent eventually, or at least to extend it. Again, this is a very expensive tax bill, and they're only, I say that in air quotes, allowed to spend $1.5 trillion over a decade. So there are a lot of these kinds of accounting gimmicks in which they say something will phase out or they say something will expire, but in fact, nobody really expects it to expire because there'll be such a strong lobbying force demanding that it continue. Whether you'll see the same kind of lobbying for, you know, the personal income tax side, the things that the middle class benefits from, I'm a little more dubious of.
I'm still trying to get my head around this from the party that was so, so strong, so strident on deficits. And now here it is baked in. Elizabeth in Fairhaven, Vermont. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. You're on.
Okay, that's good. I actually am a conservative Republican. I mean, nobody gets more conservative than me. I'm the Christian right. But I got to tell you, Donald Trump is the worst president.
What's the matter? What's the problem?
Oh, where do we start? Okay, let's just start about talking about nuclear war like it's a real thing, like it's winnable. Or let's just talk about the fact that I didn't think it was possible to make America more polarized, but he's successfully done that.
What about the taxes? We're looking at taxes, Elizabeth. What do you think?
It's insane. The only people that are going to benefit are the upper class. I mean, working class people are not going to benefit at all from this tax.
Wait, what kind of Republican are you? I thought Republicans wanted tax cuts. So what's going on, Elizabeth? Why aren't you on board?
Okay. Why am I not on board? Because I live in a poor state. I live in Vermont. And it's beautiful here, but there are a lot of people who are working class poor here. How are they going to have health benefits if there's no money in our state? I mean, if there's no money to pay for programs. I mean, there's programs that we get money for in this state from taxes, from people paying, you know, taxes on their land, and then that money we use for schools.
Yeah, Elizabeth, we got it. I'm very grateful for your call. I'm happy to have you right here. Josh Gerstein, what about the politics of this? Does it work? You know, it looks as though there's almost an effort to make it a red state versus blue state thing. Blue states are going to be hit right away by this. Maybe red states will see more of the benefit for the middle class or in general. Does that work for Trump? Does it work for the GOP?
Well, I think you guys may be drilling more into the substance than is really essential for what's being debated here.
But that's what we do here, John.
I know that's what you do. But to me, this is really a question of political urgency. And frankly, just to be blunt about it, to putting a W on the board for the administration after they've encountered so many difficulties with getting so many of their other policies.
A win here in Washington.
And so I feel that is the urgency that is animating this effort. There was some discussion earlier about Republican donors being particularly particularly interested in there being some tax cuts. But I think it also goes beyond that to the notion that core Republican voters need to see something done by this administration and this Congress if they are going to be kept in the fold during the election next year. And I think it's really as simple as that. And whether there may be a different way it plays between blue states and red states, or whether it increases the deficit, I think are secondary, if not tertiary, considerations. And the other thing I wanted to point out is you've been talking about how it's a little dizzying that Republicans seem to have given up on questions of the debt and the deficit. We should remember that the president, President Trump, during his campaign, I would say he said less about the deficit and the debt than any Republican who has campaigned for the White House, perhaps in 50 years. I mean, he said nothing about it. It simply was not a theme of his campaign whatsoever. As far as I can tell, he adheres to sort of the laffer curve crowd that we can just cut taxes and that will miraculously cause the deficit to be reduced.
He did at one point suggest that he could negotiate down our debt. So he did make some comments.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he knew how to do that. He could take care of that. And here we are going the other way, but looking for that win on the board. We're going to talk a lot more about this at the first of next week on Monday. I want to turn, if we may, to Robert Mueller and the indictments down at the first of this week against the Trump campaign chairman, manager, Paul Manafort, his close aide, and then the guilty plea that we just learned about for George Papadopoulos. Josh, this takes us right into the heart of your territory. What's most important about all that news this week? And there's been more developments in this since Monday. Where's Mueller driving with his investigation? And where's the edge of this that matters now, Josh?
Well, I would say the edge of it seems to be the more obscure person that you mentioned second there. I mean, Manafort and Gates, Manafort in particular,
Richard
Paul
Gates.
Manafort,
mm-hmm.
the president's former campaign chairman, cuts a very dashing figure in Washington. In fact, we learned this week he's known for his flashy suits, but they turn out to be very, very expensive ones, and his spending on that is pretty impressive. But this other figure, George Papadopoulos, who came up this week, he's the one who pled guilty in a closed secret hearing last month and was actually arrested by the FBI back in July for lying to them about matters relating to Russia and the Trump campaign. That is sort of the more interesting development. People had expected for a couple months. Manafort is now saying on the record that his lawyers were told 2 months ago that he was going to be indicted on these sorts of money laundering charges.
Well, pretty big money and with connections right to through the Ukraine, apparently, to the Russian leadership. I mean, that's kind of astounding, isn't it?
It is, but it, the
much guy who would be campaign manager for a president of the United States with that in his backpack.
Right. We don't want to over normalize it, right? I mean, it is an extraordinary event to have a manager of a major party presidential campaign indicted on a series of charges just months after that campaign concluded. That said, it is in keeping with what many of us have expected for some time, that amidst the millions and millions of dollars that Manafort took in for his work overseas, that perhaps taxes were not fully paid on it. There's questions about why it was stashed in Cyprus and in other countries.
Are they really
overseas
questions? I mean, these are money laundering charges, so doesn't seem like such a big question at this point. This was hidden. He's being charged with conspiracy against the United States because he didn't register as representative of a foreign government. The indictments would seem not to have questions about that. Of course, you know, there's a trial. I guess there could be a trial. Jack, by midweek, we've got this issue where you've got people looking at those photographs of the president sitting with Jeff Sessions and George Papadopoulos. We've got testimony from Papadopoulos that he was pushing them to get in touch with Moscow, and people saying, well, wait a minute, why didn't Jeff Sessions reveal that when he was in testimony on Capitol Hill?
On two occasions, Al Franken speaks of an alarming pattern of failure to tell the truth under oath. That's usually called perjury. And now when you look back at some of his statements, it's clear he's trying to parse things and in lawyer speak. But this is an affront to the Judiciary Committee. They deserve better and should demand better. This man has to tell them the truth. He did hear someone talking about Russia. In fact, his intervention at the meeting was, please don't say anything more about
this. Be fair to Jeff Sessions. He said, no, don't do that. Don't pursue that.
That's right. He said, and he could have said that in front of the Senate, but he didn't.
Here's Al Franken talking about that, what George Papadopoulos was saying apparently at that table or around that time, and what Jeff Sessions revealed in his testimony to Congress.
He had been meeting with his Russian contacts and told them that in this meeting, and said that I think I can arrange this meeting between Putin and Trump. And Sessions reacted to that strongly enough to, I believe, remember that. So I would I have a lot of questions for the Attorney General.
So he may be back. I mean, some saying he's got to come back and testify further. The White House saying nothing here that connects this to the president. Here was Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
We've been saying from day one there's been no evidence of Trump-Russia collusion, and nothing in the indictment today changes that at all.
Maybe not in the indictment. If you add in Papadopoulos and everything we've heard this week, Catherine Rampell, where do you see this standing?
This looks like very bad news for the Trump administration. Look, we don't know that Trump had any awareness of any of this. Not, you know, there's no specific evidence that has come out suggesting that he was involved.
I mean, he was at that same table, the 12-person table with Papadopoulos and Sessions.
Yeah, and in fact, his Instagram account actually tweeted it out, which I think is the greatest irony of all of this, that at the very meeting where Papadopoulos talked about potentially setting up a Trump-Putin meeting, a photo was taken and posted on Trump's Instagram profile. But in any case, you know, that looks bad at the very least for Sessions, in that Sessions testified when he was undergoing his confirmation hearings that he had no knowledge of anybody connected to the Trump campaign who had been reaching out to the Russians. And this Papadopoulos plea suggests otherwise. We also had testimony this week, maybe in the last few days, from Carter Page, who was also connected to the campaign, that he had told Sessions about a trip to Russia.
Another foreign policy advisor to the campaign.
Right, who's been doing a lot of talking in the media, and one wonders why some lawyer isn't telling him to keep his mouth shut at this point. But there are a lot of things that suggest that Sessions, at the very least, may have misled. Perjury is a whole other issue, and I'm not a lawyer, and I can't speak to that. But at the very least, he may have misled senators when he was undergoing his confirmation hearings. Again, whether that points to any culpability on Trump's behalf, we just don't know.
Facebook, Google, Twitter executives in the hot seat on Capitol Hill this week. This was Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, talking Facebook's general counsel about the impact of Russian meddling on American politics through these high-tech outlets.
During the election, they were trying to create discord between Americans, most of it directed against Clinton. After the election, you saw Russian-tied groups and organizations trying to undermine President Trump's legitimacy. Is that what you saw on Facebook?
I'd say that's an accurate statement.
That sounds pretty anodyne, but we had Dianne Feinstein drilling in further, saying, I don't think you guys get it. Here she was, the senator from California.
I don't think you get it. I think the fact that you're general counsels, you defend your company, that what we're talking about is a cataclysmic change. What we're talking about is the beginning of cyber warfare.
The beginning of cyber warfare. And Senator Al Franken of Minnesota again drilling in, saying, wait, you couldn't tell what was going on here? Some of these ads were paid for with rubles.
You can't put together rubles with a political ad and go like, those two data points spell out something bad.
Senator, it's a signal we should have been alert to, and in hindsight, it's one we missed.
Okay.
More heat coming on the tech giants here. Josh Kirstein, some of the stuff we've seen come out this week from the Russians that they were putting up, very divisive, sort of very clearly trying to pit Americans one against the other, this group against that group. Where does this investigation go of the big tech guys here? Are they in trouble?
Well, you know, this, we believe, is still part of the overall Robert Mueller investigation, and they may be in some trouble, you know, if they know that explicitly political ads were paid for in rubles. I think that is something that the Justice Department will eventually dig to the bottom of. But one of the issues may be that there was so much automation in the way this ad buying process took place that there were very few, if any, humans involved many of the times, and that people were able to manipulate these platforms, submit these ad requests without any human eyes ever seeing them until the ads were actually served to consumers like us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, it took all seven games of a thrilling series, but Houston finally has a World Series pennant. Houston Astros second baseman Jose Altuve made the final out.
Here's a ground ball right side, could do it. The Houston Astros are world champions for the first time in franchise history.
We did this for them. You know, I know it's been a lot of going on in Houston since last year, but this is because of them.
Top NPR news editor Mike Oreskes. Michael Oreskes resigned amid allegations of sexual harassment. NPR CEO Jarl Mohn faced tough questions from NPR's Mary Louise Kelly about how NPR handled the 2015 accusation.
Clearly, we didn't do everything we could because it didn't result in the right answer. But to suggest we were not doing anything or we were not acting appropriately is not or that we were doing nothing is false.
And the Netflix hit show Stranger Things is back in time for Halloween. 13-year-old Millie Bobby Brown, who plays the supernatural character 11 on the show, caught everyone up with a season one recap rap with Jimmy Fallon.
Let's go back to Indiana, circa 1983. Just four boys in the basement, chilling, playing D&D. There was Lucas, there was Willie, Will, and Dustin, there was a Mike. But one night, Will goes missing while he's riding on his bike. Yikes!
Okay, got that? Stranger Things. Bicycles, bad news there in New York this week on the bike path with that terrible attack that just mowed people down. 8 dead, a dozen injured. Many of them very seriously injured. We're looking at that and more. You can join us. What can stop the kind of killing on a bike path we saw in New York this week? Should we stop the diversity immigration lottery? Should the president be tweeting death penalty, all caps? And more. I mean, what do you make of the Donna Brazile charge that Hillary Clinton's campaign rigged the Democratic primaries last year? What about the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act being kind of buried by the Trump administration? And where does this wave of sexual harassment charges end? NPR dealing with its piece of it right now. Here's a witness of this week's terror attack in New York, Emily Long, recounting to NBC what she saw from the window of her school's library in Manhattan on Tuesday.
They're shooting, and it was like a bunch of words that were going thrown around, and I ran to the window, and I see a car, I see people dead, I see bicycles on the floor, and I'm like, what's going on? I hear helicopters everywhere.
The president's response was very fast and very sharp on this. On Wednesday, he called for stronger steps in response to acts of terror called the American judicial system, or appeared to here a joke and a laughingstock.
We need quick justice, and we need strong justice, much quicker and much stronger than we have right now. Because what we have right now is a joke, and it's a laughingstock. And no wonder so much of this stuff takes place.
Josh Gerstein, the president, very strong on this. People saying, well, wait a minute. After the shootings in Las Vegas, the message from the White House was, let's not talk about policy, let's mourn. This time, policy right away. He sort of went back and forth on this, but should the driver be sent to Guantanamo? Should it go through the federal courts or military system? Should we change big policy on immigration right away? Where's the White House stand at this week's end on the president's response? Are they sticking with all that, Josh?
They're not sticking with all of it. I mean, as you alluded to, Tom, the president kind of moved on this. Initially, he was saying this. A suspect here in the New York attack should be moved to Guantanamo Bay, very mm-hmm. outspoken that the system isn't strong enough and we're not dealing tough enough punishments. Then he started in on Twitter saying he needs to get the death penalty. But somebody educated the president. I can't quite tell you who explained that the Guantanamo process is all furled up in itself.
Super slow,
tangled in all kinds of ways that would take hours and hours to explain and has taken years and years and years to deliver very little justice, whereas people are routinely charged in federal court with terrorism-related crimes in civilian courts in the United States and are brought to trial or guilty pleas in fairly brief periods of time, like months. Now, whether the president feels that the death penalty, that seemed to be he was alluding to the fact by tougher, he meant that this person should be executed or summarily executed, it's not entirely clear. But he does seem to have said he's been told that the statistics show that Guantanamo may not be the best place to send someone, which is pretty interesting because during the campaign, both the president and attorney, the future attorney general, Jeff Sessions, were saying we needed to send more people to Guantanamo.
What about immigration policy? Do you see there's this diversity lottery that was brought in to get a more diverse stream of immigrants coming to this country? Heavy fire from the White House and more on that. Do you see that holding up? Can the president change that with the stroke of a pen?
Well, he can't change it with the stroke of a pen. And Trump in particular went after the New York Senator Chuck Schumer, who's also the Democratic minority leader in the Senate, for having sponsored this diversity program about 25 years ago. What he didn't mention
with Republicans, with overwhelming Republican support in his passage, with Republican President George H.W. Bush signing it.
Correct. And what he also didn't mention is that Chuck Schumer and other Democrats involved in the so-called Gang of Eight negotiations on immigration a few years ago agreed to do away with this program. There's no real evidence that it's a particular security threat versus any of the myriad of other ways that people come into the United States. There aren't that many of these visas. There's about 50,000, 55,000 a year that are given out. You have a lot more.
That doesn't sound that small. I don't know what
it's small not that
you,
small, but it's in the overall stream of immigration, it's not a huge a number. And you saw the president move in messaging at a certain point from the diversity program to start attacking chain migration again, which is a reference to the fact that most immigrants coming into this country, if they come in legally, do so through petition because they are relatives of people who are already here. And the administration's been on the record trying to slow or shut down chain migration in favor of what they call merit-based migration for, you know, a long time already.
John in Boston, thanks for calling, John. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be more honest and direct about the problem. You know, I think the, you know, I was listening to Cuomo and de Blasio after the incident happened, and, you know, they were speaking about they are not going to defeat us. You know, it's almost like if we were in World War II and we were not allowed to say the Germans or the Nazis, we just kept referring to the Europeans. I mean, it would be absurd. I think it's a similar situation where we need to correctly identify that he's a radical Islamic terrorist, and I don't know why we can't say that.
Well, I mean, it's one thing to say, I suppose, that. I mean, some people will quibble with that. It's another thing to say nobody from the Muslim world or Uzbekistan should be coming here. Isn't it?
Well, I think that's fine, but I mean, a diversity lottery where randomness, who goes into lottery? Maybe they... That doesn't make sense. I mean, that you need to have tighter restrictions on who comes in your country. That just doesn't make sense. You don't just let anyone in your house, in your own house, do you? I mean,
certainly not. No, certainly not. I totally agree with that. On the other hand, I mean, Josh, you cover this, Justice Department and more. Are we just letting anybody willy-nilly into the country? Is
no.
that what's happening?
No. I mean, there is a kind of randomness in an effort to spread these visas across countries where you don't have as many immigrants being admitted legally as you do from other countries. But they still go through the vetting and screening process. We are looking at, I think, 7 years between when this fellow who's this, charged in this case came to the U.S. and the crime that he committed. So, you know, I kind of doubt he's been sort of a sleeper that's been waiting for 7 years. It would seem more likely that he's been radicalized more recently. But there are screening and vetting processes, and many of the people who win the lottery never come to the United States because they can't pass that screening process.
John, sort of on the same theme here as the president was this week, tweeting, being politically correct is fine, but not for this. Then you had the New York mayor, Bill de Blasio, sort of responding to that, I think, at a press conference Wednesday, saying he was very firm on this. He said, vet individuals and thoroughly, but don't, you know, just screen out whole groups of people. Here he was, the mayor of New York.
This is a very crucial distinction. There should be very, very careful vetting of anyone where there's an indication of a concern, but not because of their religion or not because of their country of origin.
Well, okay. Dale in Franklin, Tennessee. Dale, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. I think there should be more outrage focused on our president reacting the way he did in excuse me, in particular, I'm referring to him talking about a judgment and so on. It's absolutely inappropriate for presidents to do that, and that's why they never have. Johnson didn't do it. Even Nixon didn't do that. So it's hurtful. I mean, he needs to know when not to talk.
Well, presidents always haven't always been quite as mute as you suggest, but it's always been a line to be carefully crossed. And this president, of course, he tweets and tweets a lot. And this week we kept seeing in all caps, death penalty, death penalty. Jack Beatty, what do you make of this? It's a terrible death toll on a bike path on a, you know, nice Halloween afternoon, evening in New York. And then you've got the guy who wants to put an ISIS flag up in his room at the hospital, and that's pretty grating. Then you've got a president diving in and saying, you know, really coming down hard on immigration, on going straight to a kind of a guilty presumption here, and death penalty. What do you make of the whole picture, Jack?
Well, you know, reading about the suspect, someone who knew him spoke of him as someone with monsters inside. Yeah, those monsters inside they connected with the monsters outside, ISIS and its ability to get its message out. And here, too, you know, we see the internet companies right at the center of it. After all, YouTube and the rest are one of the ways in which he gets this information. Eventually, that's got to be dealt with, it seems to me. But then the president's reaction, you know, perhaps we need to stop the diversity lottery. But the facts are, according to the Financial Times, of more than 1.5 million immigrants admitted under the program, two of them are on record as committing terrorist acts. So it's hardly a sieve for likely terrorists. And then the president's, even with the dead not yet named, he was blaming Senator Schumer for this. You know, that's a norm. A president doesn't do that kind of cheap, demagogic hit at a member of another, blaming something on the member of another party immediately.
Well, not least when lots of Republicans were on board with Schumer on that legislation years
ago. Indeed, they were, as Jeff Flake, to his credit, pointed out. So it's just another example where the president simply doesn't pay attention to the norms that govern presidential conduct.
Waji, he doesn't claim to. Waji in Tampa, Florida, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I love the show.
Thank you.
Handle the complex issues masterfully. And I love Jack's commentary. I just wanted to say this is obviously a horrendous attack, and my heart goes out to all the victims and their families. But I am disheartened that everybody's quick to call this a terrorist attack when the shooter in Las Vegas was never called, that attack was never called a terrorist attack, when I believe it was clearly an act of terror. And it's just disheartening. I wanted to quote a quick line from a New York Times article the other day, and they say that the differing responses can seem to impose a hierarchy of victims, and also they say a hierarchy of perpetrators.
Let us pick it up right there. Our time grows short, and I really appreciate your call. Catherine, how about it? You know, we've had people on the show this week saying, well, you've got to have a clear ideological reason to call it terrorism. On the other hand, gosh, the gunman in the hotel mowing down all the people at that country western concert, it looked pretty terrible. It was certainly terrorizing. Do you see a hierarchy of victims and perpetrators here?
Everybody agrees that terrorism is bad, but the actual definition of terrorism is often in dispute. It does seem as if we're more apt to apply that label when the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator is someone who is Muslim, who is not white. Those seem to be the criteria, that there's a demographic litmus test. And if it's a crazy white dude, then we're less likely to use that particularly stigmatized label. I mean, it's not only Las Vegas, right? There was the shooter who shot up the Republican baseball practice.
Yep.
And he was white, and I don't recall that label being applied to him. But it's political rhetoric that is selectively used.
It is certainly terrifying, terrorizing. We've got to go to this DNC thing. Donna Brazile was interim chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee. She has now come out, forthcoming book that says the campaign rigged the presidential nominating process. Here's a little commentary from Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren on CNN agreeing and saying that Tom Perez, the current DNC chair, is facing a big test.
Either he's going to succeed by bringing Bernie Sanders and Bernie Sanders representatives into this process, and they're going to say it's fair, it works, we all believe it, or he's going to fail. And I very much hope he succeeds. I hope for Democrats everywhere. I hope for Bernie and for all of Bernie's supporters that he's going to succeed.
Very quickly, Senator, do you agree with the notion that it was rigged?
Yes.
Elizabeth Warren says yes. Jack Beatty, the president all over this here, says, look at this, look at this. Are you buying it, Jack? This was rigged.
Well, it certainly looks bad. And basically, the Democratic National Committee was running out of money. The Clinton campaign said, we'll give you money. In return, we want this, this, and the other, including just issues on personnel, on what they were to say. On
a lot of sway.
And then on fundraising, they were going to, dip in and take as much of that money as the DNC raised as they possibly could. So, yeah, it looks like the kind of, brutalist politics that the Bernie people were saying all along the Clinton campaign was guilty of and was in cahoots with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC. Now we know the depth of that cahoots.
We will have more on that on this show. Catherine Rampell. Now we've got at NPR charges of sexual harassment from of a top editor there, Michael Oreskes, much of it from an earlier time in the 90s when he was a Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, but also at NPR itself. Well, is anybody immune from this, Catherine?
Well, certainly there seems to be an unleashing. There's like the dam has broken in that a lot of major figures in media and in other industries who have been allegedly preying upon women and others are now finally being accused because victims feel free to speak out.
Top editor out at NPR, and that parade goes on. Sadly, very grateful to the three of you for being with us today. Catherine Rampell, columnist at The Washington Post. Catherine, wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was great to be here.
Josh Gerstein with Politico, covering the White House and the Justice Department. Lots of action in both this week. Josh, thanks for your time and insights.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, great to have you as always. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.